So we have much to be thankful for with respect to the sermon, because it's really long. So today, I made kind of a table of contents. Rachel gave me some good feedback on another sermon she saw with a table of contents. And so here we go. We're going to try and put this in here to help us see our way through. Now we're going to start with geography and reruns. We'll talk about whether or not some things are familiar. We'll talk a lot about how and why. This is going to be more background information to our passage. And after we get done with the how and why there in the middle block, we'll actually talk about our healing of the deaf mute and feeding of the 4,000. Now, even though those last two are just two entries on this long list, they're going to be a relatively substantial chunk of the sermon as well. So as we follow along, just know those last two lines, even though it looks like we're getting close to the end, we're nowhere near there. Everybody ready? All right, let's roll. Geography and reruns. How many people live in the house where you were born? Maybe you were born in a hospital, but they brought you home to that house, and you still live at the same house where you first started living. All right. How many people live in the same house where you were born? I know Verity does. Okay, Verity does. Have a few people, right? It's not super common. I lived in the same house for 16 years growing up, and this is that house today. It's gone. It was an old farmhouse. It was built in the 1865, the end of the Civil War. It was pretty old. You could see through the cracks in the floor, the floorboards between the actual floorboards that had popped open, and it used to sit right there in that little hill. And back behind it, there is, along this road that it was on, there's a big bluff, right? And that's important because the geography is important to our Bible story, and it's also important to this little discussion about reruns that we're going to make. Because as you look off to the north from my house, there's a river valley that's nice and flat and clean. And when I was a kid, I was kind of like Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes and really liked the television. Here he says, "O great altar of passive entertainment, bestow upon me thy discordant images at such speed as to render linear thought impossible." Right? And that was kind of me as a kid. I really liked TV. It was wrong. It was bad. I shouldn't have, but I did. The problem for me, though, was I only got four channels. Okay, and where I sat there at that little red bump, that little red flag here on this bluff that was to the south of me, right? I could not get the TV channels from Springfield, Illinois. I could only get the TV channels, those four, from Peoria, way up there. You wouldn't think that. Like, I'm way closer to Springfield. Now, why does this matter at all? Because Springfield had the Transformers on them. And that was a new TV show that all the kids wanted to see because it was cool. It was about robots that turned into cars, that turned back into robots. They were Transformers. Guess what played on the Peoria TV channels? Reruns of Gilligan's Island. So I can have long discussions with my grandparents about the TV show that they used to watch when it was cool and first on. So I was pretty sad about reruns. I didn't really like them, right? And we may feel, when we get to this section of Mark, you may be like, man, this is really familiar. Haven't I seen Jesus heal people in crazy ways? What's different about this deaf-mute guy that he's healing? Haven't I seen him dealing with big crowds of people? I mean, we fed them on a hillside earlier, and there was more of them that time. There were 5,000 last time. This time, there's only 4,000. So we are going to dig into the background of these miracles because that's what's going to help us to see why we have these miracles recorded as well as those first examples. Okay, so these aren't reruns. They seem similar, but they are not the same miracles. Okay, so we're going to talk about where these miracles take place first. And that's important because before, there were the first red arrows pointing there at the north end of the Sea of Galilee in Capernaum, which is in that purple part labeled Galilee. That was where those first two miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 and the healing of the paralytic who gets let down through the roof, who's brought to Jesus, those two miracles happen in Galilee, which is a Jewish territory. So it happened among crowds of Jewish people and was done to Jewish subjects. All right, so Jesus had gone from Capernaum 34 miles northwest to Tyre and Sidon in that region someplace. We're not sure where, so it's approximately 34 miles. There he met the Syrophoenician woman, and he talked to her, and we talked about that last time. But he doesn't stay there. Okay, he comes back And as the beginning of our passage says, he comes back around the Sea of Galilee, but he doesn't go back to Capernaum right away. He comes down into this region labeled the Decapolis. And the Decapolis, as you can tell by the name, the opolis ending to it, is a Greek area. Right? That sounds like the ending that you would have on a lot of different Greek cities. So opolis, Decapolis, actually means 10 cities, and there were roughly 10 Gentile or Greek cities. Okay, why is that important? Well, it's important because of the who. Who are these miracles happening to? And like I mentioned, the first ones in Galilee, they were happening to Jewish people. But the Decapolis is full of Greek people. Which, I mean, if we go back to that map, like I don't see Greece anywhere on that map. Why are there Greek people there? Well, let's talk a little bit of Holy Land history, right? So, who was it who took the Jews from Jerusalem captive and hauled them off to a faraway land? Who did that? Nebuchadnezzar. He was king of Babylon. Okay? And so the Jews were taken away captive to Babylon. How long did they stay captive? 70 years, right? 70 years captive in Babylon. Okay? But while they were in Babylon, there was a king who had a big feast. His name was Belshazzar. Johnny Cash sings a really awesome song about this. While Belshazzar is sitting at his feast, he sees a finger doing what? A finger from nowhere. It's writing on the wall. And during the 70 years while the Jews are in Babylon, there's a finger writing on the wall, and Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, gets overthrown. And he gets taken over by a completely different empire. And so that empire that took him over was the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire was a huge empire that spread all over the Middle East. Israel's this little kind of orangey area down here that used to be Assyrian at one point, gets taken over by these Persians who came out of this area of the world. And the Medes, who came out of up there by the Caspian Sea, they had kind of joined together. We have the Medo-Persian Empire, and it comes over, and it takes over Babylon. It takes over the people that were in charge of the Jews. And the king of the Persian Empire sends a remnant of the Jewish people back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Right? But that Persian Empire doesn't last. As the book of Daniel predicted before any of this happened, a Greek man arose from Macedonia, the northern part of Greece, named Alexander the Great. And he comes along and he takes over the entire Persian Empire. He takes over the entire known world. But anybody know how long Alexander the Great lived? How old was he when he died? Anybody know? What? 32 or 33? I love homeschooling crowds. They're so good at these questions. All right. So Alexander the Great only lives 32 or 33 years, right? And he dies. And he dies early, a little bit of a surprise, but at a drinking party. He gets really drunk. He may well have been poisoned. But he dies. And what happens to this huge empire that had taken over all of the Medo-Persian Empire and everything else? Well, they fight over it and they break it up into little chunks. So all of his generals fight over it. And there weren't just a few generals, but there were a few that kind of rose to the top of these battles that were happening. And so, as it turns out, the Holy Land ends up being fought over by a few of these different groups. We go back and look at that map one last time. You can see right over there, Gaza is the label on this map, Tyre to the north. The Holy Land's in between them. And this purple down here and that orange up there kind of blend together right there, right on top of the Holy Land. Because they were at the juncture between the different kingdoms. And multiple times they were taken over by different generals of Alexander. And so we have a rather vicious pulling apart or tugging on the Holy Land. This is during 300 on through 200 BC. Basically 200 years before Jesus' time, 300 years before Jesus' time. Now the forces that were pulling on the people and the land of Israel, the Seleucid Empire was one of those Alexandrian empires, which obviously Alexander from Macedonia, Greeks. Greek people were in charge of the Seleucid Empire. They were culturally Greek. The Ptolemaic Empire in Egypt is pulling on them. They are culturally Greek. When the Greeks took over a land, they wanted to make people like them. They wanted them to worship the same gods that they did. They wanted them to have the same culture that they did because they thought their culture was right. They were very proud of it. But in the land, you had the Kassim in Israel, who were basically the granddads of the Pharisees, the people who would become the Pharisees eventually. And you also had the nationalists. So the Kassim were very religiously conservative, wanted to keep the same religion that Israel had always had and not become a Greek religion. The nationalists wanted to be in charge. And they didn't really care what religion you had. They eventually become Herod and the others there. This created a huge amount of tension in the Holy Land. So when we talk about Jews versus Gentiles or Jews versus Greeks, the term Gentiles just means nations, the other nations. The word other is kind of implied in there, but Gentiles is nations, the other nations besides the Jews. They were different in clothing. They were different in language. They were different in religion, food, politics, money, and everything. And we've talked about last time how the Pharisees had those very rigorous laws about how you had to dunk yourself completely, wash yourself off, not last time, but previously. We've talked about how they had the very specific laws about how you had to cleanse yourself if you even came in any contact whatsoever with a Gentile as a Jewish person. So the fact that Jesus is doing these miracles not on Jews this time, but on Gentiles or Greeks, not in Jewish territory, but now in the Decapolis, in a Greek area, is very important. And it's important because the question that was at stake is the messianic mission. Who was the Jewish Messiah coming to help? And for the Jews, that was a really simple question. Us. Who's the Jewish Messiah coming to help? Us, because we're Jews. He's Jewish. We're Jewish. He's helping us. We're supposed to take over because he's going to be in charge of everything. But that's not what their scriptures actually said. Isaiah 49:6, indeed he says, it is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also give you as a light to the Gentiles that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. Isaiah, Old Testament, right there, the Jewish people could read that and see that, could be very aware of it. Malachi 1:11, from the rising of the sun even to its going down, my name shall be great among the Gentiles. In every place, incense shall be offered to my name and a pure offering. For my name shall be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. And then in another passage from Isaiah, a little more extended one, behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one in whom my soul delights. That's clearly the Messiah. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail, nor be discouraged, till he has established justice in the earth. And the coastlands, where the Philistines, the eternal enemy of the Israelites, it seems, live, and the coastlands shall wait for his law. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread forth the earth and that which comes from it, who gives breath to the people, all the people on it, and spirit to those who walk on it. And in this promise, we also see to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the prison, those who sit in darkness from the prison house. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will not give to another, nor my praise to carved images. Behold, the former things have come to pass, and new things I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. God had told the Jews that he was coming, and he would bring glory to himself, not just from the Jewish nation, but from all the nations of the earth. Everyone, he had come. So while the Jewish people would say that who's the Jewish Messiah coming to help? Us. And Gentiles would probably say, I don't know, who's the Jewish Messiah? The correct answer, as taught in the Old Testament, is that the Jewish Messiah was coming to help everyone. And that was not a popular or widely held view in the culture that Jesus was doing these miracles in. So let's talk about details. How and why details? We've talked about the history of the Holy Land, where those people groups come from, why they were at each other's throats. We talked about the messianic mission, what people thought it was, what it actually clearly was from their own scriptures. And now let's talk about the details of how miracles get done. Now, how many people like to cook? Right? How many people have to cook? All right, some people have to cook, right? All right. Every once in a while, I'll go on YouTube and I'll watch how they make something that I might want to make. Not every once in a while. All the time, I'll go and watch people who cook interesting things because I liked cooking shows as a kid and I still do. But one thing that always amazed me when I watched a cooking show was that they had all the ingredients ready ahead of time. Does anybody do this when you cook? Does anybody get out matching sets of pretty glassware and put every ingredient separately and line it all up and then look at it and say, this is going to be fun? I'm diving into the fridge, looking in the cabinet. Do I even have flour? I don't know. Right? That's what I'm doing all the time when I'm going to cook. But okay, the recipe, the ingredients in a miracle are important. Okay? And anybody want to guess what those are the ingredients for? Meatloaf's really close. I mean, meatballs. It's actually meatballs. Now, I would say meatloaf is just about the same thing. But anyway, so this is meatballs. Now, if I was going to do something else, I'd have different ingredients there, right? When we look at the miracles today, we're going to talk about similarities and differences to previous ones that we've seen. And we're going to talk about what those ingredients, those methods can show us and tell us and teach us. Just like we can guess what dish we're making from the picture of the ingredients, we're going to try and look at what happened with the deaf mute and what happened with feeding the 4,000 and kind of understand what it is that we can from those methods. So in order to do that, we're going to look at our story thus far in the book of Mark. So miracles in Mark so far. This is the first slide for this. Mark 1, Jesus cast out an evil spirit by command. Still in Mark 1, Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law just by touching her hand. After that, he healed many and cast out many demons, but we don't have the details of how he did it. But we know that people brought many who were sick and many who were demon-possessed to him, and he cast them out. He heals a leper by touch and by speaking both. So he not only touches the man, but he also speaks over him. In Mark 2, he perceives in his spirit how others were thinking. When the man is lowered through the roof, he perceives in his spirit and understands what other people are thinking when not what they've said. He then forgives sins with a word, and he heals that paralytic man with a word. He heals on the Sabbath, interestingly, by an indirect command. He doesn't touch the man. He doesn't do anything to him. He does no apparent physical act. He simply says, stretch out your hand, and it's healed. Mark 3, he gives his disciples power over sicknesses and demons to get rid of them. In Mark 4, he calmed the wind and the waves, again, just with a command, with a word. He casts out demons. He gave them permission to pig out, and then down the hill into the water, right? We remember that story. He healed many. He cast out many demons again, but no specific details about how he does it. In Mark 5, we saw the woman touch the hem of his garment, and power went out from him. She was healed, even though in his human capacity, Jesus didn't know exactly what had just happened. Right? So in his nature as God, he knew. He knew all things. But in his human capacity, he didn't know what had happened. He took a little girl's hand, and then he spoke to her, and she came back to life in that same chapter. And again, he gave the disciples, he took his power, his authority, and he gave it to his disciples and gave them power over unclean spirit. Mark 6, a miracle we're going to talk about more later, feeds 5,000. He blesses the bread and then he hands out the fish. He walks on water like it's no big deal. In Mark, we don't see Peter walking on the water, but We see Jesus walking on water like it's no big deal. He's going to walk right past his disciples. In Mark 6, it says that every sick person who touches him is made well. In Mark 7, we start to see him doing things without even being there. He casts out a demon by word, sight unseen. Yeah, that was with the Syrophoenician woman. So methods and motivations, what's going on with all these different miracles? Jewish people had books that had recipes for exorcisms in them. They had magic incantations that were nonsense words that you were supposed to recite. They had all sorts of medical books in the ancient world about how you would take care of problems. We remember the ones we talked about with the lady who had the flow of blood who touched Jesus' garment. All sorts of crazy ideas of if you did this, you mix that, you put that there, you'll be all better soon, we hope. Cross our fingers. Right? So why does God use the methods that he does? The Gospel of John, chapter 9, 1 through 7. I consider this the weirdest method. I don't know, maybe today's deaf-mute man is strange as well. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." That's what this miracle is. It's a work of God that's being revealed through this difficulty, this challenge, this thing that has been a probably crushing burden on this man his entire life, has been there so that the works of God could be revealed through him. What glory. This blind man gets to be known throughout all eternity, gets to be known through generations and generations of people to come because of the works of God. So Jesus says, "I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with his saliva. He anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and he said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Jesus takes from his body, he spits on the ground, he makes it into clay, which reminds us of Adam being taken out of the clay and made by God. He anoints the eyes of the man with the clay. He gives him a command to obey. The man has to go off. He has to fulfill the command. He has to come back, and then he's been healed. But if we look at another story, a different healing, Matthew 8, 5 through 9, we saw this story in Mark as well. "Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, 'Lord, my servant is laying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented.' And Jesus said to him, 'I will come and heal him.' The centurion answered and said, 'Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it.' When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, 'Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel.'" Why is this miracle happening? To display the faith of this man and also to illustrate it to those all around and to us throughout the ages to see the power of the faith that that man had. "And I say to you, that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven." Again, something they didn't believe at the time. And I'm going to challenge us a little later and ask if we really believe that. But we'll get there in a second. "But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Take this home, squish it on his face, and then wash it off in this special water over there." Oh, no, it doesn't say that at all. The method is completely different. This man has come to Jesus. He says, "I know you can do this. You don't have to come to my house." And Jesus says, you're right. It's true. Go your way. As you have believed, so let it be done to you. Jesus never sees the servant that he heals. And his servant was healed that same hour. Completely different expression of power. Now, why all these different methods? It really can be thrown under the overarching statement in John 20. And truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. You. These signs, these wonders are done so that you may see them, and that seeing them, you may believe them, and that you may have eternal life. So, we've talked about the Holy Land history, we've talked about the Messianic mission, we've talked about our story so far in the book of Mark, we've talked about the methods and motivation of miracles in general. Let's take a look at our two miracles from this passage. Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of the Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. We talked about why that was important. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him, just like with the Jewish paralytic who they tore apart the roof and lowered him down. Friends, someone else, they brought this man to Jesus, and they begged him desperately to help him, the same way that the friends were desperate enough to tear apart the roof to let that man down. Now, different from that paralytic, he took him aside from the multitude and put his fingers in his ears and spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened, which is Aramaic, the common language. Ephphatha is in the common language of the people in the area. So Jesus takes this man apart from the crowd. And what obviously the disciples were there, they observed it, they watched it. But this wasn't a show. This wasn't Benny Hinn on a stage slamming somebody in the forehead and having them fall over and proclaiming them healed. This is Jesus Christ taking this man aside, and that sigh is compassion. That sigh in the Greek, in the text, means he had compassion on this man. He saw him, he saw his struggles, his difficulties, and he had compassion on him. This healing was for this man. And so we see the method that Jesus uses is incredibly personal and very direct. It addresses exactly what's wrong with him. He comes up, he takes him, he puts his hands in his ears. This man's deaf. If Jesus tried to explain to him what he was going to do, is he going to know he's going to heal his ears? No. He comes up to him, he takes him, he touches him, he shows him, I'm going to heal you, right? And he gives him another physical sign by using his saliva, right? And touches his tongue. And he heals him with a word. He commands, be open. It is a personal, compassionate miracle, and the methods of it show that. Now, even more so, Jesus says at the end, he commanded them that they should tell no one. This isn't a thing for everybody out there in the crowd. I took this man aside. I did this personally. This is for him. This is out of compassion for him. But the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. And so Jesus Christ, out of compassion and love for this man, carries out a miracle, and yet it still, despite his telling everyone not to proclaim it, it still declares his glory and his power. Okay, let's take a look at feeding the 4,000. Another miracle among the Gentiles. So the Jews versus Gentiles aspect of this one is going to be very important because, like I said, feeding the 5,000 was with the Jews. Feeding the 4,000 is with the Gentiles. So we've got two parallel miracles that God does that are very, very similar. So chapter 8 opens, in those days, The multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion, again, compassion, on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. First off, we see a similarity. Both in the feeding of the 5,000 and in the feeding of the 4,000, Jesus declares his compassion. I have compassion on them. I'm concerned for these other people. I want them taken care of. Interestingly, the Jewish 5,000 had only seen that Jesus was trying to go apart with his disciples and ran out of the villages that very same day. They were only 1 day separated from any place with food, but the Greek 4,000 have followed him for 3 days continuously, listening to the lessons he's teaching them. The Jewish people didn't bring any food along. That's why they didn't have any food to eat. The Greek people have run out of food. They had brought food, but they've run out of food. The Jewish people came from the surrounding villages. They came out from the Capernaum from around there, and they followed the boat that they saw sailing away, and they knew where he was going to try to be by himself, and they came right there, and they were close by. The Greek people had come from afar. Christ comes first to the Jews in the Bible, and then to the Greeks. First to the ones that are close by to the knowledge of the history of salvation, and then to those that are far off and haven't heard the story ever before, but he comes to both groups. Then his disciples answered him, how can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness? He asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, seven. Now, a little Greek lesson here. When the disciples are talking about the Jewish 5,000 people, they say, how can anybody give these people enough bread to eat? And they use a word that comes from the same word as phagocyte. If anybody out there is a biology homeschool student, phagocytes are cells that eat things. White blood cells are phagocytes. They eat things. So that's just the Greek word for eating food. But when they talk about the Greek 4,000, they say, how can one satisfy these people? That Greek word satisfy is actually chortezo, which is the same word you use to describe feeding livestock with hay. So the disciples say, how are we going to feed these Gentile livestock with hay? The implication is there. It's a little strong for me to say that they are saying that, but they are using a word that you would use in that situation. Jesus also uses that word when he talks to the Syrophoenician woman, when he says that the little children need to be filled first. So there's a certain element of complete filling that goes with it, but it is in its base meaning about livestock. For the Jewish 5,000, Jesus takes five loaves of bread. For the Greek 4,000, it's seven. I'm not big on numerology, so we're not going to try to tear those numbers apart, but it's different. It's what was there, what was present. Jesus took what was available and used it. Now, 6 through 10. So he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. That Greek word is for bare ground. That'll be a difference in a moment. And he took the seven loaves and gave thanks and broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled. And they took up seven large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. Immediately got into the boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha, which is probably back on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So let's look at, again, a few differences that are clear here. The Jewish people were asked to sit down on the grass. They actually, that miracle is almost certainly around the time of the Passover in the springtime. This second miracle with the Greek, it's bare ground. The Greek word means bare ground. So they're in a wilderness in bare ground where there is no other possible supply of anything. When the miracle of feeding the 5,000 happens, Jesus only actually blesses the bread, which is following Jewish custom. The Jews would only say a blessing over the bread part of the meal and not over any other part of it. because that's literally what the Old Testament said. So they were literally following the letter of the law exactly. But the Greek custom was to say a blessing over all of the food that you ate. And so Jesus says a blessing over both the bread and the fish that he multiplies. The baskets, the Jewish 5,000 had 12 picnic baskets, roughly. It would have been a small handheld basket for carrying a little bit of provisions. The seven baskets that the Greeks take, that they take up when they feed the Greek 4,000 in the Decapolis, those are the same baskets that Paul gets lowered out of the city wall with later at Damascus. Those are bushel baskets, giant baskets, storage baskets, hampers, if you will. So, which one, the Jews or the Gentiles, were God's favorite? Which ones did he feed better? Correct answer, both. Jesus loved both those groups of people. Jesus loved the Jews who had known about him, who had been raised in a culture that spoke of him constantly, his coming, though they didn't recognize him. And he loved those Gentiles who had no idea who this guy was, but they could see that he had power and that he was speaking the truth. So the answer is both. So, who does God want to save more, a Pharisee or a tax collector? The answer, both. A harlot or a noble lady? Both. Someone who dresses modestly or someone who wears lewd clothing? Both. A tattooed person or a person with clean skin? Both. Someone raised in a Christian home or someone who's part of the LGBTQ movement? Both. God saves whom he will save. He loves and chooses those whom he loves and chooses. We, as those who are going to go out into the field that is white for the harvest, need to be prepared to go to anybody, whether we find them to be a savory character, somebody we like and would want to, or an unsavory character, someone whom we might be disgusted by the habits and behaviors of. We need to love them the same way Jesus Christ loved and touched a leper, loved and fed the 5,000, loved and fed the 4,000 who were Gentiles and come from a foreign culture. That part of the Gospel of John says, but these are written, these stories that we just read, these miracles are described to us, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, is the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Miracles are so that you and others who hear about them can come to know Jesus Christ and be saved. And these stories, these miracles, were not restricted just to people that would look nice sitting in a pew on a Sunday morning, not just to people dressed well, not just to any category. They were for everyone. The King James says in John 3:16, anybody have John 3:16 in the King James ready at hand? Exactly. That whosoever believeth in him, whosoever believeth in him, it's anyone who believes on Jesus that can be saved and that will be saved. And that's through the power and the call of God. So as we go out into the world, as we go out there to do God's will and God's work, I want us to go out there with open minds, open eyes, open hearts to everyone who's around us, whether they look like they can be saved or should be saved or any of those ideas that pop through our heads or not. A friend I was talking to at Bible Bee got fired from his job, had to go back to work for a company that he had worked for before as a contractor. And he finds himself working next to a guy who's cussing and swearing and taking smoke breaks on company time and tattooed out gills. And partway through one conversation, the man declares that he's a Christian. And my buddy looks at him and is like, okay, Eddie, sure. But the next day, Eddie asks him, man, I'm trying to stop swearing. I don't know how to do it. You got any advice? Because I notice you never say anything bad. And so my friend realizes suddenly that if he hadn't gotten fired from his job, if he hadn't gotten put on this humbling experience of working for the company he used to work for, he would have never met Eddie. And he would never have had the chance to right then and there start discipling him, which was what he continued to do. So God will give you opportunities, but they might not look like you expect. Let's go to him in prayer and pray that we have open eyes to see those opportunities and the courage to take advantage of them. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for Jesus Christ's example on the earth, the way that he loved all people who needed him, the way that he is offered freely to whosoever will believe in him. We love also, Lord, that you foreordained some of us to come to you, and that we never would have done it of our own will. But Lord, we pray that you would give us wisdom, give us courage, and help us to see and take advantage of the opportunities that you have for us to do your will, to speak of the miracles of Jesus, to testify to his importance and meaning in our life, and encourage others, no matter whether they look like who we think they should be or not. Lord, please pour out your Holy Spirit upon this congregation and empower us. Give us strength and power and love for our fellow man. Give us the right words at the right times. And Lord, give us faith and courage to leap when you call, to leap up and say, "Here I am, Lord, send me." In your holy and precious Son's name we pray. Amen.